I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Anne Filippi, founder of The New Health Club. If you want to know about psychedelics as new mental health tools, you came to the right place. I talk to innovators, thought leaders, and disruptors creating the future of mental health and mental wellness. And we think that the future is already here. Hi, and welcome to a new episode of The New Health Club Show. My guest today is Lars Christian Wilde, President, Chief Business Officer, and co-founder of Compass Pathways, the mental health care company dedicated to accelerating patient access to evidence-based innovation in mental health, as they describe themselves. Compass was one of the first companies engaging in a bigger vision of the substance psilocybin. I remember talking to Lars in one of the first podcasts of the New Health Club, and one of our topics was if there would be a vaccine against depression. Still an interesting thought to me. I also remember how openly Lars talked about his treatment-resistant depression and anxiety disorder and the effects it had on himself and the people in his life, and how he told me about his treatment with psilocybin that helped him tremendously. I'm always a fan of people, especially entrepreneurs in the psychedelic field, that share their psychedelic experiences and are personally affected by the power of psychedelic substances. But now to our conversation about Compass Pathway. In 2020, a lot of things have happened at Compass. In September last year, the company became a public company, listing their stock on NASDAQ and raising $146 million. Compass has become one of the most exciting companies in the field very fast. So Lars and I catch up. What is happening in the Compass world right now? How does a public company feel different? How does the Compass and the Shepherd Pratt collaboration looks like, since Compass is opening a center of excellence in collaboration with the Shepherd Pratt Institute for Advanced Diagnostics and Therapeutics in Baltimore, Maryland, to do more research. Their psychiatry department exists since the 1800s, so Lars and I talk about how you can implement old research data from the beginning of psychiatry and the new psychedelic research and how this can look like. We talk about Compass study in collaboration with the Charité in Berlin and how to conduct the study in times of COVID at all. Plus how COMP360, a psilocybin therapy trial for treatment-resistant depression, will work. So please enjoy the episode and Lars. So Lars, brackets Christian Wilde, you're on the show for the second time, and I think like in this year, the last year, like it feels like 5 years than just 1 year what has happened. So, and just correct me if I'm wrong, but at the moment, so you're the co-founder and the president of Compass Pathway, right?
That is correct.
Okay,
yes.
Good. And so, of course, pretty much everybody will know the company who's listening to this podcast. But first of all, we already talked a little bit about it. How did you guys proceed last year when the pandemic was hitting and all the trials were just set up and then you had to stop? How did you manage through this?
Yeah, that's a great question. Indeed, it's been a crazy year for everyone. Just further emphasizing probably the need for new therapies in mental health, actually, when you look at the rising numbers through the increasing isolation. Maybe something we can talk about later. Mm-hmm. In terms of our COVID response, I remember it was in February, so right around the time a year ago. We were in London with the team, had team meetings in the office, and together decided very early, actually, to shut down the office. Because mm-hmm. Obviously, we can work remotely. We're in that fortunate position. We don't have any production, and Obviously, the trials are run by our university partners, and so we could actually give people the freedom to work from home early. Then when we said, I remember we had a discussion with our team, and we said, okay, now is the time to actually take action. Our office is in London in Paddington Station, so the whole world is traveling from Heathrow to Paddington, basically through our office. And so we said, okay, that's really the worst place to be in. The situation was completely unclear what COVID was and what it, how severe the situation might turn out. And so we said, look, we shut down the office and we work remotely. And we did so before. We were used to working on Zoom. There was always, in any meeting, there was a colleague that had to dial in. And so that was not a big change for us. I remember everybody said, you're crazy, you're overreacting. And then 3 weeks later or so, the whole world shut down. So I think we did it at the right time. And then in terms of, obviously, the... you know that we're running our Phase 2B program in North America and in Europe. Mm-hmm. And the study had to stop initially. We had to assess the situation. Now we're live again in 10 countries, 22 sites. So we cope really well with it. We're not losing much time. And so that went well. But I think, you know, we all... I mean, you know, this situation, we're all pretty much fed up with being only virtual, just lacks the human touch to be in person. And
But I mean, like, do you think that, excuse me, that in, let's say, like the studies also would have to then be led like half or like maybe full on digital? So how important is like the... You just mentioned it, like the human touch for studies. I mean, it must be super important also, right?
Look, I believe so. We know, for example, the therapeutic alliance between the therapist, the lead therapist, and the patient is really important. And so we cannot lose this, right? Psilocybin therapy happens in a mental health care facility and under the guidance of a trained therapist. So we can't, and we don't want to get rid of that aspect, but there are many ways around this. And so, for example, we are able to have sessions digitally with the patients for preparation and integration. Mm-hmm. For example, we have remote follow-up visits on the depression, severity of the patients post dosing. So we see that probably as many companies experience that COVID is a little bit of a catalyst to drive change that was already coming, but at a higher speed now.
Like with everything, with digital worlds, with like you mentioned it earlier, with the recognition of the mental health crisis also. That it's kind of unstoppable. But quickly coming back to last year, I mean, if you kind of review the year last year, like 2020, leading up to the IPO, so what would you say was the biggest changes or things you maybe kind of never really thought about earlier last year? Because, I mean, I feel, and we talked about it before we started the recording, it's kind of, it feels like an accelerator for everybody. And by the end of 2020, things had happened that nobody expected in January 2020, for example. So how does this look in terms of Compass?
Yeah, that's a great question. Probably if you were asking different colleagues, you would get different answers based on their perspective and what they are active in. So I can speak maybe for, I can touch on different aspects of the company maybe. So obviously, in terms of the clinical trials, typically our clinical operations team would travel from site to site and be very much out there at our clinical trial partners. And we always had in-person training for our therapists, etc. So we had to reinvent this whole logistical apparatus, which obviously initially created a lot of hectic in the team, and I think they did it extremely well. So that's running like a well-oiled machine. And then on the other hand, as you know, we went public last year, and in order to get public, we also closed another private financing round in March, or right, yeah, I think it was around March. So just 3 weeks into the crisis, and everybody said, look, oh, you're never going to close a financing round. The world is going to stop. And you know how investors are in capital markets, right? You saw this huge reaction where all the stock markets dropped and investors lost confidence. And we were lucky that we had amazing investors on board that at no point considered pulling out of that fundraising. And so that happened all online already without a lot of in-person interaction. And when you look at it, right, the round we raised was 80 million. So without actually meeting the investors in person.
Oh, wow.
Or some of the investors. Some we met earlier. But, you know, and then we teed up for the IPO preparation. So the idea of the IPO was to access the capital markets to raise the funds required for the late-stage clinical trial programs, eventually commercial build-out to bring the therapy to patients. And if you raise these amounts of capital, eventually you need to be a public company because there's only so much capital the venture capitalists will be able to provide you as a private entity. So we had to prepare for the life as a public company. Our research team was growing, the financial team was growing. And so we onboarded so many colleagues that we've never seen live, right? And so you'd run all the interviews in person, you never shook a hand.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting experience. And so obviously we grew and we prepared the IPO. We had hundreds of investor meetings in this format on Zoom, simply where the normal modus operandi would have been to be in an airplane and go from major capital market city, London, New York, San Francisco, Chicago, etc., meet all the investors. And we did all of it on like we do now on Zoom. And so instead of doing a 2-week roadshow for an IPO, we did it in 4 days, for example. And so the world really, like you said, changed, accelerated. What we learned is, and maybe that is really important, is you know, oftentimes in psychology, people say depression is a disease of disconnection. And the lockdowns worldwide created this perfect storm of isolating people in their apartments, reducing their contact to nature, to their friends, to their social connection, to giving them a feeling of connectedness, maybe in their jobs. And so we saw this huge explosion globally in depression, and that's going to stay with us. And so that for the team made it much, you know, it emphasized the need to move very quickly to get psilocybin therapy to patients. It was an exciting year that emphasized how important it is what we're doing.
Do you feel like a different person now in an IPO company?
Yeah, I remember actually George and Katya, my co-founders, and I, we spoke the day after our IPO or the weekend after the IPO. And we said, look, do we feel differently? And the answer was absolutely not. It was just, to us, it felt very much like another financing round. And because, you know, for us, really, very little changed. Yeah, there's a little bit of, you call it bureaucracy, or, you know, as a private company, you have a bit more leeway. As a public company, obviously, there are restrictions on information sharing, for example. There's obviously all the compliance with the SEC. But once that is organized, the focus is still on patients, right, and psilocybin therapy. So,
but wouldn't it give you also like an energy flash that this is possible, because you were pretty much the first ones, right?
No, I mean, no, that happened a little bit before, because we saw that this would happen, right? And so I think what it meant to us, actually, probably the round that we raised in spring basically showed up. Investors have fully come around. They see that there's a lot of promise in psilocybin therapy. The regulators believe in it. We had great interactions with insurances that are looking to be involved if psilocybin comes to market. So that boost of confidence that this is really possible, that came earlier. And yes, it was maybe further emphasized by the IPO, because that means we can raise all the required funding for the phase 3 and for the rollout. Absolutely.
Because, I mean, like, suddenly I met friends who were like, yeah, we just bought Compass Pathway stocks. I was like, so this is really happening. So, I mean, it just, to me, like, even 2019, like, there were so many people saying, yeah, this, nobody knows when this will happen, and it can maybe it can go wrong and then everything starts from the beginning. So, and then 2020 was like the total confirmation that this is a serious industry also, that is that people would rather invest in now than Amazon or Facebook, my friend, definitely, for example.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is true, right? I think this is important. It is a major opportunity to kind of set the record straight and really fund the research required to figure out how is psilocybin therapy or psychedelic therapy at large ideally delivered to patients, and how do we create a change. I think it also led to some irrational exuberance. You see now, I mean, you know, right, there are a lot of former cannabis entrepreneurs and gaming and mining gaming, entrepreneurs that suddenly have become biotech entrepreneurs. That, but you know, I think I caution everyone. This can only happen through rigorous science. I believe that's important, and you know, I applaud anyone else who's trying to do this in a rigorous manner.
But I mean, also, what happened last year is in the American election, showing how people wanted to have this treatment. And like we said this so many times already in other interviews, but there were, I feel like, 40 articles after the election, even in very conservative surroundings, or like even magazines like Fast Company, all of them saying drugs are the big winner of the election. So, I mean, what did, for example, the Oregon model mean to you, that the whole development that has happened in Washington, but also in Oregon? Was it something you guys were kind of reacting to, or like getting in touch? And because, I mean, it seems like it already says it's going to be a model for the future for other places.
Yeah, I think it was a huge vote of confidence by the population and change in mental health, and they see the promise in the therapy. So absolutely great to see that the awareness has reached such a level in the wider population, both on the side of recognition of mental health suffering and the need for new solutions, which I feel that the US are really leading in terms of that public perception, that the studies are out there. There's a lot of hope around psilocybin therapy. As you know, Anna, the situation in Germany is still very different, right? Yeah. If you go to psychiatrists here and tell them, look, we're developing psilocybin, they still might think you're a bit too far out there. So it just shows that we still have a way to go. I think it's exciting, and drugs won the election. That's a funny way to put it. I think it's important, right? I think we, as a team, believe, or as a company, we say, look, the war on drug has failed, right? We see a massive crisis, especially in opioid abuse, and we have great role models in Portugal and the Czech Republic, where all drugs have been decriminalized, and people are not criminally penalized for using drugs. But if they have a drug abuse habit, they're treated as patients, right? And I think that's the way that hopefully the world is going to develop over the next 10 years. And yeah, I think there's a clear path forward now. If the science holds up for psilocybin to become a real option for patients.
So psilocybin seems to be now the most, the most classic thing to research, I would say, in the meantime. And I mean, but before we come to this research center you guys are actually working with now, I mean, I feel, and maybe also because of lockdown and because people can't travel to like other places and to the Netherlands or something. So my feeling is that ketamine therapy has become very popular because you can do it in the cities also, like where you live in. And I mean, I started one, was it last year? Yeah. And then now I'm in my second round, and I think it's so interesting, and it feels like, why is this not more communicated to so many people who, I mean, I just kind of started to work on my own things that came up during last year. But I mean, it's kind of interesting to me that there's no communication at all about the possibility that you, like how you could already use it right now, like without being doing something illegal. So, but I mean, coming quickly back to the to your study that you started at Charité in Berlin. Can you talk a little bit about that already? Is that what you have to set up?
Maybe on the ketamine part, right? I think ketamine is a phenomenal treatment.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
With great backing, with great research backing. Yale has done a lot of work on it under John Crystal, Jerry Sinacora, which for the first time showed that it's a rapid acting antidepressant, and especially for people that are in a suicidal ideation crisis, right? Mm-hmm. It might provide immediate relief. The effects are not as long-lived as they seem to be with hopefully psilocybin, right? You see that patients typically improve for a few days, and then if they are in a really deep depression, they need to come back for another treatment. But it's a real option. The problem, I think, that exemplifies is how important it is that a drug is developed all the way to market. Because for ketamine, there are these academic studies, and yes, they look great, but ketamine has not been approved. So that means that if you want to have it, it's an off-label treatment. So the prescribing physician needs to make a decision on a per-person basis. Typically, it's not reimbursed, therefore. There is no wider awareness in the key opinion leader community. Had someone taken ketamine all the way through phase two, phase three, worked with 100 clinical trial sites in let's say Europe and the United States, there would be a very different awareness. And then you could go to the national insurances, work with them on a reimbursement model, and then people could access the treatment. So that is the step that is missing for ketamine. That is the step that's going to be different for psilocybin, right? Once it's developed and the insurances reimburse it and the prescribers are aware of it, then patients can actually access it and there will be much more awareness of it.
But I mean, do you think that there will be more studies on ketamine also, let's say, in Europe? Because, I mean, like you said, in Yale, you can even watch a couple of YouTube videos about this, how Yale is researching it for a while. But I mean, it's interesting that it's there and it works for a lot of people on a very different level. So, and why do you think there are not real ketamine studies happening here?
Yeah, the problem is that there is no company behind it that has a motive to develop it, right? And as we see with psilocybin, it takes hundreds of millions to develop a drug through all the required studies, the regulatory studies, and then the studies to actually generate the evidence that the insurances can look at and say, is this a cost-effective treatment for patients compared to the standard of care? And no one is taking ketamine because there's a lack of financial interest in it as well. Ketamine is very affordable, it's off-patent, etc. And therefore, we don't see ketamine moving forward. J&J has developed one of the isomers of ketamine, esketamine, all the way to market. But the interesting thing is that ketamine consists of two isomers, R and S, and they seem to be somewhat synergistic. And so it would be very interesting to actually see a head-to-head comparison between esketamine and the racemic ketamine. And it's interesting. It seems that the U.S. Payers are partnering up to compare esketamine to racemic ketamine to find out if indeed racemic ketamine is the winning drug.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
If it is, they might actually reimburse it in the United States, and then you could see ketamine being rolled out.
I mean, I think it's going to be a very interesting tool for the future to really, I mean, besides the for people who are like feel suicidal, which a lot of people seem to feel at the moment because they can't cope with it anymore. But besides that, it's also an interesting tool to really start to communicate with yourself on a very different level and on a very healthy level, I feel, that is really kind of giving you information that you have forgotten or that are important to put your topics together in a very different way. So I'm a big ketamine fan, obviously. But coming back to Charité, so can you already talk a little bit about how you guys, what are you actually researching before we come
absolutely.
To the Shepard Pratt Institute? But of course, a lot of people in Berlin would like to know what is actually happening.
So Charité is our clinical trial site in Germany for the wider phase 2B program, our phase 2B where we are researching psilocybin therapy for the treatment of treatment-resistant depression.
Mm-hmm.
And our partners at Charité are involved in that study. And we're treating a total of 260 patients in that program in Canada, the US, and then eight European countries, one of which is Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And we're really excited about having such a reputable institution part of that study in Germany, obviously, because that will also start the dialogue in Germany to look at the science and consider the benefit of psilocybin therapy.
So can you talk a bit about what the study is exactly about? So is it a comparison between psilocybin and SSRIs?
Great question. Mm. It is not.
Oh, okay.
So this is a... The official term would be a dose-finding study. We are having three arms in that study, 1 milligram, 10 milligram, and 25 milligram. The study has a power of 90 to detect a 6-point difference on the MADRS depression rating scale at week 3 after dosing. And then we're comparing the 25 milligram and the 10 milligram to the 1 milligram dose in that study. And maybe the 10 and 25 milligram doses have been tried before. For example, the study that was done in treatment-resistant depression at Imperial College in 19 patients, they were pre-treated with 10 milligram dose to familiarize themselves with the psychedelic experience, which did not have any major antidepressant effects in that study. And then they received the 25 milligram dose, 2 weeks after, and they had a massive antidepressant response in that study. And so the idea is that, across different nationalities and different trial sites, that we can still show a strong effect in that study, confirming what the active dose would be. And then hopefully after successful completion of the phase 2B program, we would then take the active dose into a phase 3 program again in North America and Europe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You already mentioned it, that the topic in Germany is kind of still kind of a very difficult one could say. But I feel this year, also because of the other study from the, Professor Gründer and the Mind Foundation the Zentrum für psychische Gesundheit in Mannheim. I mean, that's a study that was co-founded also by the German government. So I feel like maybe by 2021, there will be a whole different attitude in Germany also, because the government literally gave money to this. Do you think this will affect the perception?
A huge vote of confidence, obviously, somewhat reputable as Gerd Gründer, who's obviously one of the leading key opinion leaders of Germany, an amazing researcher, to look at this seriously in a second study, hopefully confirming our results.
Mm-hmm.
I think Germany is a country with amnesia, because it's very interesting, until the late 1990s, when everybody in the US always says, oh, there was a ban on psychedelics in 1970 and everything stopped. That's directionally correct in the US. It continued for a couple of years and then funding dried up and the field moved on. That's not true in Germany, right? Mm-hmm. We did the last psilocybin studies in the late 1990s at the University of Cologne. And Germany was amongst the leading centers, if not the leading center in psilocybin research at the University of Göttingen, where hundreds and hundreds of subjects were treated with psilocybin for all kinds of disorders, not only depression, but eating disorders and so on. So we have a very rich history in Germany of psilocybin research with amazing results. But when the field stopped and all the researchers of that generation retired, somewhat this knowledge was lost. And so I hope that with positive results in that study, in these studies that you just mentioned, hopefully also people will revive that knowledge and will realize that we have quite a history in psychedelic research in Germany.
Well, Merck, MDMA, 1913, and Bayer, heroin. So, everything happens in the Cologne, Düsseldorf area.
Absolutely. MDMA, mescaline, Hefter, right? So, or Switzerland with Sandoz, right? They discovered LSD, and they discovered psilocybin as the active alkaloid and in magic mushrooms, and created a lot of novel psychedelics as well early on at Sandoz, and those were also researched in Germany. So indeed, there's a rich history.
But let's quickly come back to the Shepard Pratt Institute. So you talk about, or like in the articles I read, so it's basically presented as, I mean, the Center of Excellence will model the clinic of the future. So can you talk a little bit about how this clinic, the clinic of the future in terms of psilocybin treatment could look like?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're trying to find out together with our colleagues at Shepard Pratt. Maybe to take a step back before diving deeper into Shepard Pratt, what was really interesting, what we saw in our phase one program was that we dosed up to six participants at the same time in the same room. And when you compare that to the other studies done in the last 20 years with psilocybin, it was always one patient, two therapists in a room. And so we thought about, you know, is that really a requirement? Or could we do it in larger groups? And in that study, we had 90 participants. They all decided to stay in the groups. They could isolate themselves. None of the participants did that. We were also able to not have two therapists per participant, but only one therapist per participant, which obviously will lower the cost to the system if you need fewer therapists. And the most interesting result is that we had the lowest anxiety rates in any of the modern day psilocybin studies.
Wow.
So that might be a chance result, who knows? But we discussed it with the PIs, and the PIs' opinion is that maybe the group experience has a calming effect on the participants, right? If you never had a psychedelic experience and suddenly you realize that your perception of reality changes, you might get nervous about it. But when you look around and you see it happens in a group to everyone else, this might have a calming effect on the participants. And so that was a very interesting result. And from there, we actually got involved in a major depression disorder program in Maryland, where we, under our IND with the FDA, there are groups of four. So patients are prepared in groups of four, they receive psilocybin in groups of four, and they integrate in groups of four for the first time in patients. And so when we think about how do we scale this, right? If the studies are successful, how do we scale this in the real world? We believe that simultaneous administration, which is a kind of group administration, might be the way forward. So when we think about the clinic of the future, what we want to understand is what is a commercial model that makes sense. And maybe the answer is that a patient that has a first psilocybin experience needs to do it in the more traditional model, alone with a therapist. But maybe once they're familiarized and they have a follow-on session of psilocybin therapy, for example, maybe they can do it in a group. And so that is one of the aspects that we're really interested in, that we want to research in the future. So we talk about the clinic of the future, the idea of the centers of excellence. There are a couple of objectives we have. We need to train a lot of therapists that we can do through the center of excellence model. We need to create awareness for psilocybin therapy. So we want to have a place where we can go with payer systems like insurances or state payers, where we can go with leading partners from mental health care hospital chains, for example, or psychiatrists that have their own clinics. So they come to a place and look at what should psilocybin therapy look like. And then the question is, Anna, where can we take psilocybin therapy beyond depression, right? Everybody at the moment is very much focused in our team on delivering a world-class treatment-resistant depression program. But we did a lot of research preclinically, and obviously there are also some academic studies in other psychiatric disorders and substance abuse disorders with phenomenal results. And so now we're looking at where can we go next. And Shepard Pratt is one of the world's leading institutions in psychiatry, seeing 70,000 patients in their wider environment. And so they are an ideal partner for us to investigate these new areas. And so, for example, one of the studies we're looking at together with them is bipolar type 2. So bipolar depression is obviously a huge need. We're looking at suicidal ideation. Back to the ketamine point, right? We know what is the benefit of ketamine is it works immediately and takes people that do respond out of their suicidal thought patterns. And the question is, might psilocybin do the same, just with a longer duration, so that the patients don't have to come back the following day for a follow-on session? And then severe TRD. At the moment in our TRD study, we're looking at patients.
What is TRD?
Good question. Treatment-resistant depression. So in our core program, treatment-resistant depression, we're looking at 2 to 4 pharmacological failures in the patient's current episode of depression. But obviously, there are these people that have had depression for 10 years on end, and they have failed many more treatments. And oftentimes, these patients end up in a state where they're on very heavy antidepressant medication. It could be antipsychotics, tricyclics, lithium, etc., or progress into electroconvulsive therapy, which is very efficacious, but obviously has a huge side effect profile, right? People are put under generalized anesthesia. They are electro-shocked to create a state of convulsion that seems to reset the brain, but it comes with a real irreversible impact on the brain. And so that is one of the, that's called the severe TRD population. That is something that Shepherd Pratt is interested in researching with us. And so we're broadening out the portfolio into new indication areas with them. The idea is to run small studies that don't take much time. And as soon as we have a signal, we would move them into large trials similar to our phase 2, phase 3 program.
And I mean, I read that they exist. The Shepherd Pratt Institute was founded in 1853. Which is super interesting to me, because I was thinking, do you guys, I mean, obviously they already also looked into mental health treatments since then. So do you look into studies they did on the topic that are maybe like 50, 60, 7, maybe even like 100 years old, or like experiments? Because I mean, there were always like, if you look back in the history of studies, there are often hints that one could find, but they weren't executed because it seemed crazy, or it seemed not really realistic, or just too expensive. So is there kind of an archive that you guys are working with, what they already researched since their beginning?
That is a very interesting question. And indeed, when you look at the studies that have been done in psychedelic research over the last 20 years, while they seem very novel and exciting, they have all been done before, right? Mm-hmm. If you go back to the 1950s and 60s, they might not have been done with psilocybin. They might have been done with LSD or mescaline, but we're just replicating what has been done before, because back then we didn't have the same definitions of a disease that we have today. Today, we are much more skilled in identifying what problem a patient has, and we have more advanced statistical methods. We have double-blind placebo-controlled studies that were, back in the days when psychedelic research was at its peak, still the rare exception in research, and therefore it makes a lot of sense to replicate these studies. And I think the when you go back in psychiatry, there's this disconnect between psychiatry and psychology in the past, right? At some point, the psychiatrists tried to tweak a little. They thought it's some chemical imbalance in the brain that needed fixing. And then on the other end, you had psychologists who said, look, psychiatry doesn't make sense at all. And I think now we see more convergence of both fields, where people say, how great is it if we can help people with a medical intervention that might give their brain the ability to change, but at the same time, we bundle it with a therapeutic intervention. And so I think that's where psilocybin therapy comes in, right? You have these strong biological effects of psilocybin, for example, the reduction of inflammation in the brain or the increase of neuroplasticity that give you the ability to make changes, and then you have the therapeutic intervention. So I'm pretty sure there's a lot to be learned still from what has been done in the past. But as you might know, there are also very abysmal practices in psychiatry when you think about lobotomy, example. And
does that still exist, actually?
Luckily not. I was surprised. I recently read this. There was an interesting article in the New York Times of the history of psychiatry, and I think lobotomy came to an end in the late 1980s, which is shocking that it still went on for so long. Another one that was very popular in the 1950s, 1960s was insulin overdoses. You basically injected insulin to create a state of hypoglycemia, to induce, for example, convulsion, that was then replaced with electroshock therapy. And the really negative, apart from that, was very little scientific backing for these methods. Oftentimes, a lot of that happened against the will of the patients, right? If your family decided you have a mental illness and you need a treatment, then often these treatments were done against your will, which is shocking. And so obviously psychiatry has progressed a lot. And I think that we should rather learn from the mistakes that have been made. And
well, at one point you didn't have a will anymore, I guess, right? After a couple of these treatments, you were just...
Yeah, and I think that is exactly where psilocybin, you know, that is what happens when you see people that are sometimes put on 3-4 antidepressants at the same time, right? You lose your overall emotional response. You become somewhat...
Yeah.
You don't really care about... You lose your sense of agency. And it seems that psilocybin is doing exactly the opposite when you look at the results of the academic studies, right? Where patients come out and they say, suddenly I have full agency again.
I'm an astronaut.
I want back my lust for life. I want to do something with my life.
Yeah, that's
right?
Great.
And so that's exciting, right? And if we could show this with Shepard-Pratt in other indication areas, that would be phenomenal to do that with such a reputable research institute.
Well, it seems also that the research for agency is like one of the most important things at the moment. I mean, again, especially in the pandemic, where a lot of people rethought their agency or what they wanted to do with their life anyway. So it seems like another contribution to look for support systems that can help you in finding this agency again. But I mean, we have to talk about the treatment called COMP 3060, or do you say COMP 360?
We say COMP 360. Yeah.
Okay. So I mean, which is, if you read it up, it's described as psilocybin therapy trial for treatment resistant depression. So maybe you can talk a little about how this look like, or how this will look like if this comes, let's say, I mean, to the market or as a treatment in hospitals.
When we looked at developing it, right, we asked ourselves the question, where's the need the biggest? And we didn't answer that in a vacuum, but we obviously worked a lot with our scientific advisors. We worked with the regulators. And the clear guidance there was focus on treatment-resistant depression. That is where the need is the biggest. And when you look at, for example, the STAR*D study, which is the largest depression study ever done, you see that when patients become depressed for the first time, typically they go to their GP and they describe that they are in a state of sadness, and that's oftentimes the first symptom they describe to their practitioner, and they have a lack of energy. And so then typically they're put on an SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, and a third of patients respond really well, just takes them out of that hole, and they go on with their lives. Then the two-thirds that don't respond, they come back a couple of weeks later and say, hey, I didn't really get a response from it. And then the physician often prescribes another SSRI or an SNRI. Again, another third respond. So two-thirds of patients are really well treated with the existing treatments. But then you have that third that does not respond. And then it becomes really very quickly a problem, because then they have already failed these two treatments. Then typically the GP says, look, you got to see a psychiatrist. The patient goes to the psychiatrist, and then the psychiatrist doesn't really have any measurement tools. So they start, they look at the guideline, and the guideline might say, look, give them a tricyclic, give them an antipsychotic, try to get them onto psychotherapy, which, the waiting lines are very long. To get an appointment if that's supposed to be reimbursed. And so that's where it becomes very difficult. And that, unfortunately, impacts over 100 million patients globally. And that was before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So with the pandemic, we know these numbers are rising very, very sharply. And so that is our focus. So now think about this patient, hopefully after approval of psilocybin therapy, right? They come to their psychiatrist and they say, look, here's what my GP has prescribed. This hasn't worked. And then hopefully the psychiatrist is aware of the ability to prescribe psilocybin therapy. And already today, we're speaking with some of the large mental health care providers in Europe and the United States. And so what we expect is that the clinic systems will build out treatment rooms. You will have the larger psychiatric practices that consist of psychiatrists and psychologists that will have the treatment rooms to run psilocybin therapy. And then the patients will largely go through similar scheme as they do in our phase 2B program. They will work with a therapist to be prepared for the session, meaning to approach it with openness and to learn some coping mechanisms to breathe through any turbulence during the actual experience. Then the experience happens in a clinic, either in a session where the patient works with the lead therapist, or maybe even in the future, as I said, in somewhat of a group setup. And then the patient will again, afterwards, integrate the experience, which we believe is crucially important right there. When we look at the more qualitative analyses of the studies, oftentimes patients say something like, this felt like 20 years of psychotherapy condensed into 6 hours. Mm. For the first time, I understood why I became depressed. I realized what behaviors don't serve me anymore. I realized what relationships don't serve me anymore. And I realized what relationships I neglected, what behaviors I neglected. So they have clear insight. If they then process that together with the therapist, we believe this contributes to these positive long-term outcomes. And then maybe the last thing to say is that we are seeing that digital health becomes just mental health treatment. And so the idea that we have with our team is to look at what are the most promising tools that patients might be able to use in the future to support, hopefully, the positive effects of psilocybin therapy. For example, we're working on a digital phenotyping solution, which would allow us to, on a per patient basis, predict the patient's relapse. And we know that, you know, some patients that do respond to psilocybin therapy, they improve for 3 months, mm-hmm. others for six mm-hmm. months, others for 12 months, others forever. But the response is very, very varied, right? And if we could then say, look, Lars, you know, you're out of your depression, but now we're seeing that you're worsening. You're going back to your old behaviors based on your, for example, mobile phone use. and then we could invite patients back into the clinic and have them have another psilocybin therapy session before they become depressed again. That would be the holy grail, because we know that at every point in time when a patient becomes depressed again, the chance of recovery is only 50%. And so we hope that this will be the model of the future, where patients have the ability to access psilocybin therapy in that safe environment.
If you really think it through, that let's say at one point the whole world is able to do psychedelics based on their depression, or to use it as a tool to cure their depression, it's something I really think a lot about recently. That do you think that the human being will actually be changed after this? Because I mean, I think everybody who started to do psychedelics in a safe setting and in a rather maybe medical therapeutical approach, even then you realize how certain things that like you said earlier used to be very important are completely kind of disappearing. And also a lot of things that were related to consumerism, or like things that one gets told in education, like owning six houses and five cars and, you know, kind of all this kind of, you should be so-and-so, you should do this and this. And I feel if really, like, let's say, I mean, it's just like a, like an idea, but if like the whole world population would actually undergo this, what would that actually mean? Do you ever think about that?
Look, I think this, yeah, I do. Not on the abstract philosophical level necessarily.
No, and in a practical level.
But I think on a very practical level, because when you look at, you know, what is depression, right? There are different theories, but one that I find very convincing is that it's somewhat an evolutionary adaptation to adversity and to stress, for example, or to trauma. And, you know, what traumatizes people and what creates stress, right? When you look at countries that are very egalitarian, where people have a social safety net, when you look at the Scandinavian countries, and you correct for impact factors like it's dark for 6 months of the year, right? If you correct for that, the depression levels are much lower compared to states, to countries where you have a very capitalist system without that framework, where when people become sick, that they have general health care or that they have a social security net. So there's this constant stressor. And, you know, this is an interesting one to observe, right? If, you know, if people are caught in that rat race of this constant stress and they can't free themselves from that, then you have that stressor that will always make you depressed again, right? And so what we see with psychedelic therapies, right, the integration part is really important, to your point, right? If you can reassess what actually matters, and are you really focused on the things that matter? When we look at the studies and patients come out of these studies, oftentimes they say, oh, I realize I neglected my family. I neglected my friends. I realize nature matters a lot to me. I need to be more outside. I need to take care of my body, right? All aspects that are known to contribute to a good mental health. So like you said, right, if patients have that mental reset and they focus on what matters most to them, I hope they get better in the long run. And if that happens at a large scale, hopefully we have a more kind society to each other.
I think it's totally realistic. I mean, I think it's something that will change things that we can't even think of right now. Like, we couldn't think of having a Tesla car like 10 years ago, for example. Seems like, yeah, well, it's totally normal. But 10 years ago, it was like a total Back to the Future scenario, movie thing or something. So why shouldn't the world be kinder after psychedelics? So it could be.
Look, I think I just to quote, you know, I'm no expert here, right? But I like what Rick Doblin says, right? We had a discussion two years ago, I want to say. And someone asked and said, look, why did the psychedelic movement fail in the 1960s and early 1970s? There was all that great research. It was helping patients. There were already clinics treating people. You know, why did it all come to an end? Why did it fail? And so then Rick paused for a bit and he said, well, it didn't fail. It was too successful. And that's an interesting one. And he said it threatened the establishment back then, right? We were much more there was a power culture. The U.S. were at war in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. What happened is they couldn't find enough recruits anymore in the young population because, as you know, LSD had escaped the lab.
Sure.
And people that had an LSD experience said, look, why should I fight a war if I could rather think about a green revolution or energy change or female rights, black rights, the anti-nuclear movements? So all of these movements came out of this psychedelic world.
That's interesting. Yeah, I never thought about this. Yeah,
and so I think the positive benefit that you're talking about, right? I think if people become kinder to themselves, you know, first you need to heal yourself to be there for others. I think you're right. If that happens at scale, hopefully this will have a major impact on the world.
I mean, we have milk that we put in a coffee made out of peas right now. I mean, I never thought that somebody would have told me this. And I'm obsessed with it. It's just the best milk ever. It's like how fast this goes that you adjust to things. It's also very interesting. But before we go, I'd really like to talk a little bit about a Compass offering like public market shares. So, and because I'm just wanted to quickly talk about this because I feel in my kind of a lot of, like I said, a lot of my friends are suddenly to start and invest in this. And I feel it's a kind of an interesting mixture of investing something with a purpose that it's not just anything that has not such a great purpose maybe in the end. So, but a lot of people actually are wondering how to approach this. So, I mean, in general, the psychedelic investment, but I mean, of course, yours is out there and it's a very attractive company to invest in. That's what I hear from people who are really know a lot about this. So how would you say somebody should approach this? I mean, I know you communicate with your investors, you have a special website where one can get information and just maybe get a little bit of advice. So or let's say, how would you like to people approach this that are just getting into investing and also would like to invest because it's a great company with a great purpose?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And look, I would advise people that look at investing into psychedelic therapy, developing companies, and to think about what's real. Mm-hmm. Right, you have a lot of these companies that consist of a fancy PowerPoint presentation, but it's really about running these large scale studies in order to be successful, right? And then I think, obviously, we're very transparent with the work we're doing. Key focus is depression. Now we're looking at all these new indications. I mentioned some of them. Others we're looking at is autism and anorexia. Mm-hmm. And so we're broadening it out. And so I think then as an investor, right, your decision needs to be, do you believe in psilocybin therapy? And then you can look at what's going to happen at Compass in the future. Obviously, we're going to have the results from the phase 2B program, and then people need to make their assessment. Do they believe this has a good chance to be successful? If the answer is yes, then that should influence their investment decision. And I think that's the way they should think about all companies in that space. I think what is really important to us is that we're not we don't define ourselves as a psychedelic company, mm-hmm. But really as a mental health care company, because we're somewhat agnostic. We just believe that psilocybin is one of the most amazing tools out there to change outcomes for patients. But we're looking far broader than that. I mentioned digital, for example. We're looking at other mental health innovation at the moment. And so whatever brings hope to patients is something that we're interested in. Mm-hmm. And so that's how we define the company. So whoever is interested in investing in mental health should absolutely look at Compass.
And I mean, like we talked in our first podcast we talked about you undergoing a psilocybin experience and getting in touch with the changes that can actually bring to your mental health. So have you done anything else in the meantime, or was that? I'm just curious. I always want to know about the experiences of others, if you want to talk about it.
So look, I think the interesting thing, maybe to answer that question, is that I told you, Anna, that my first experience that really helped me with my own depression, mm-hmm. and anxiety in 2016. And what is really amazing is that I'm still having insights from that experience, right? There were things that became very clear to me of what matters to me in my life and things that don't matter. And so, for example, I realized how much I love nature. And so I moved, one of the results that I then implemented is I moved out to the woods. And so, you know, I can take a walk whenever I want in the forest, for example. Mm-hmm. I realized I definitely wanted to have kids. I have a little daughter now, 1.5-year-old. Wow. I have another one on the way. So I think I realized who's important in my life, who my friends are, who I want to stay in contact with. How important my own health is, for example, and, you know, all these things I'm still I have very present, mm-hmm. In my mind, mm-hmm. and I think that is one of the things that gives me a lot of confidence in our work. When I look backwards, you know, now 5 years ago, mm-hmm. I had that experience, and still today I'm using what I learned from it. And I think, as Michael Pollan said, right, on a rational level that is clear to you before, but it just sinks in on a different level, mm-hmm. In a psychedelic experience. And so maybe that's the best way to answer it. In the past year, I still benefited from an experience I had 5 years ago.
So you're still working on your integration.
Absolutely.
Which is totally what my experience too, that like so many things popping up suddenly in a moment where you don't think they would pop up, where you can connect dots that you couldn't connect, and then kind of go to make different decisions based on these dots that are connected. So I totally can see that this lasts for like a long time, how this implements in your life, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's important, right? I think the integration part is, you know, there are those people that probably you know, I know that take psychedelics very regularly, but you don't see them change.
Yeah.
And so
yeah,
it's become, so it's really important to focus on the integration part if you want to see change in your life. So,
Lars, it was great to have you on the show the second time. A lot of things have happened, and thanks for being on the show again.
Thanks very much for having me on it.